West Express is the premier publisher of writings about Sherlock Holmes and his world. It doesn't matter if you've just discovered the great detective or you're a seasoned Sherlockian, or whether your tastes run to scholarly essays or pastiche, you'll find something splendid to pique your interest, including The One Fixed Point in a Changing Age, a new generation on Sherlock Holmes, edited by the Baker Street Babes. West Express is also proud to present another in its series of blockbuster Sherlockian conferences, From Gillette to Brett Thor, Basil, Benedict, and Beyond. Featuring exclusive 75th anniversary screenings of Basil Rathbone's The Hound of the Baskervilles, a roster of incredible speakers, and a live interview with Mark Gatiss of BBC Sherlock fame, don't miss this incredible event from September 12th to the 14th at Indiana University. For more information on Wessex titles and Gillette to Brett, visit www.wessexpress.com.
The Scintillation of Sion is an annual symposium held in Maryland, USA for fans of Sherlock Holmes, Dr. Watson, and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. It is sponsored by Watson's Tinbox, and if you would like to know more about their next event, their website is www.scintillation.org.
The Baker Street Journal is a leading Sherlockian publication, with features written by the readers for the readers. It contains both academic articles and light, fun reading for any sort of Sherlock Holmes enthusiast. If you're a fan of The Great Detective, The Good Doctor, and the other works of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and you'd like to know more about the journal, how to subscribe, or how to offer your own services at writing an article, their website is www.bakerstreetjournal.com.
It is 1947, and the long-retired Sherlock Holmes, now 93, lives in a remote Sussex farmhouse with his housekeeper and her young son. He tends to his bees, writes in his journal, and grapples with the diminishing powers of his mind. But in the twilight of his life, as people continue to look for him for answers, Holmes revisits a case that may provide him with answers of his own to questions he didn't even know he was asking about life, about love, and about the limits of the mind's ability to know. We sat down with author Mitch Cullen about his novel, the UK release, and the upcoming film starring Ian McKellen.
Oh, they call us the irregulars, but baby, we're always on time. Baker Street babes always leave the rest of them behind. Oh, so in Scotland Yard they send you home, you feel like you're losing your mind. If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you two to one?
Now, I want to warn you guys, I am a lapsed Sherlockian, so you're
That's fine, I haven't read all the books.
Oh, okay, so I don't feel so bad. I've read them, but, I mean, ages ago, really, so...
Your book is a liar, it says you're the biggest Sherlockian fan in the world.
I know, it's a lot to live up to. I was.
Now, meh.
Meh.
Well, that's going to be funny, because the first questions we're going to ask are, like, our standard Baker Street Babe questions.
Oh, yeah.
To initiate you.
Give it to me, babes. I'm ready.
I'm so good too. All right. So, yeah, how did you get into Sherlock Holmes?
It was in Santa Fe, New Mexico, in the around either late 70s or early 80s. There was a Sunday afternoon show called, and my memory tells me it was Sherlock on Sunday, but I don't think that was actually the name. But basically, what they did is they showed the Basil Rathbone, Nigel Bruce, Universal Sherlock Holmes movies. You know, like Scarlet Claw and, yeah. You know, these World War, they're all kind of World War II-y things going on. But I was sucked into it. I just thought it was the greatest thing. And so that was my gateway drug. And then this, either fate or pure coincidence, I'll tell you what I used to do, is I would watch them, and this, we didn't have a VCR, so I had a cassette recorder. So I would wind the microphone over the TV and record the audio off of it. And then at night, I would play it back in bed listening to it. You know, I did this for Godzilla movies, too, which makes no sense. But then one day, my dad came home and said, did you know that the world's largest Sherlock Holmes collection is in Santa Fe? That's where I was living, Santa Fe, New Mexico. And I did not. And it's true. It was a guy named John Bennett Shaw.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know about John Shaw?
Yeah, yeah.
John had, and he was... also one of the American representatives for the Conan Doyle estate, you know, so he was hooked up, and he lived very close to where I lived, and I called him up, and as a little boy he invited me over, and it was just kid in a candy store kind of stuff. And he had everything. I am not joking. And he loved the pastiches too. He was anything Sherlock. He had everything from the Tsar's bound copy of Hound of the Baskervilles with the crest of it to pornography.
Which that was Sherlock. The book, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah, it does. Yes, that's right. Very good.
Like, I read. No, you,
yeah. And John was just an amazing man. He was this really. He looked like Mycroft Holmes. He was this massively large man, and just gregarious and funny. And then he got me into the Brothers Three of Moriarty, which was I guess they called themselves a Scion organization at the Baker Street Irregular.
Yeah.
So I was the youngest member at 13 of the Brothers Three of Moriarty. That was it. I was just really hooked. And in the summers for a while there, until puberty really kicked in with a vengeance, because that's when I kind of waned. But I was just knee deep in it. And John would pay me to house sit his library in the summer while he and his wife went on vacation with bound copies of Strand magazine. And I still have those. They're in my office. But yeah. So not bad. Not a bad thing to have. I have no idea what they're worth. I bet they're worth something.
They're worth a lot of money.
Yeah. He also got me the complete shooting script for The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes.
Oh, wow.
So including all the stuff that was cut out.
So you're not home right now. So if I
could... there's a window open. No, I shouldn't say that. But yeah, that's so. And it lasted quite a while. Also, at the same time, I started buying... they're on cassette tapes at Walgreens, which was this kind of... convenience store place. Do they have Walgreens? They don't have Walgreens.
We don't have Walgreens over here, but some of our listeners will know what you're talking about.
At Walgreens, they used to sell these cassette tapes of old radio shows, and I, with my allowance, would buy them. They had the old BBC, John Gielgud, Ralph Richardson.
Yeah.
And so I started buying those, and then that was my actual real introduction to the stories, were John Gielgud and Richardson doing those, and then I started reading them, and then collecting, you know, books and stuff, so yeah. Did that answer it? Was that a...
Yeah.
It was a good answer. Yeah.
Like, you mentioned a few adaptations, because obviously you make a reference to the Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce stories in the book.
That's right, yeah.
I giggled a lot at. You just mentioned the John Gielgud ones. What's your favorite adaptation of the stories?
I've always been partial to the Hammer films, Hound of the Baskervilles, but that's might be because I just really love Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee. So I like the atmosphere of it. Although I think the Basil Rathbone Hound of the Baskervilles, although it's been a really long time since I've seen it, was pretty good, if I remember. It was not bad. And then I like the BBC, was it BBC, the Jeremy Brett?
The Granada.
ITV Granada.
Granada, yeah. That I thought were really, really good. But yeah. What are yours? Do you have a favorite?
My heart and soul belongs to The Great Mouse Detective.
Oh, that's a good one. Good one. Good answer.
But yeah, definitely a BBC Sherlock.
I don't know. Since watching The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes, I think that's quite a big contender now.
Would that count? Could I count that? Hands down would be it.
Yeah, I think.
I thought you meant one literally from.
Oh no, it can be anything. Oh, well, then Grace Maldon's Great Mouse Detective. Barely interpretive.
Then it would be that Private Life of Sherlock Holmes, and it would be A Study in Terror, which I really love.
Okay.
With Robert Neville. Sherlock Holmes.
I don't know if anyone's ever mentioned that one before.
No, actually,
I don't think it's even out on DVD. I've looked
really?
For it. You can watch the entire thing on YouTube, I think.
There's a lot of stuff there.
I've definitely seen it on YouTube.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Not that you should watch things legally on YouTube.
No.
Not that we advocate that.
No. Or buy books. Don't check them out from the library. No.
Now, you said that you haven't read all the stories, but of the ones that you have read of the canon, what's your favorite one?
Hound of the Baskervilles. I like the novella. I like the longer pieces. I like the novellas. But that Study in Scarlet I like as well. Because I like Irene. Irene? Do they call her Irene? I've heard it.
I don't know. There's been a lot of debate about what her name is.
It's Irene or Irene. Were they saying or not Irene?
Yeah, because it's more of a...
very weird.
It's more of a kind of like Eastern European.
It depends on where you think, because... Yeah, from Scandal in Bohemia, so if you think that she's from, like...
Oh, that's right, Scandal in Bohemia, I said study.
They say that she's American, and I don't know anyone in the States would ever call someone Irene.
Yeah, I think Irene.
Let me correct myself. I meant A Scandal in Bohemia.
Scandal in Belgravia.
A Scandal in Belgravia.
Strike.
Yeah, I'm dying. Oh, man. Can I call a friend?
Do you have a lifeline?
yeah, I'm gonna lie.
So Irene is your favorite character?
I like it. I like the ones where Sherlock gets bested. You know, I think that's fun. You know, and it feels like that's those kind of touches that make him seem believable. I think.
that make him seem more human.
Yeah, yeah, I like that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, you've answered the Bakery Babes question, which means you are now an honorary Bakery
Babe. Do I get anything? A pin?
You do.
I do.
Yeah.
She's reaching inside her bag.
Nice.
It's going to be a
gun. Oh,
a bikini.
Oh. You guys can't see this on the podcast, but I get a Baker Street Babes pin, which I will wear. Peter will tell you. I collect pins.
And
I used to make pins for the Huntington Library bookstore until they actually fired me from the job because I was making Renegade pins. I was pulled into an office and treated
early
really
rebel.
Yeah, well, they were really worried about it at the Huntington Library. But but thank you so much. I will treasure this.
You are welcome. All right, so a slight trick of the mind. It came out, it was a decade ago in the States.
It was a lot thinner.
It was 2005,
and
really,
I had nicer
like 10
hair.
Years ago.
Yeah, that makes
sense.
That's when I graduated high school. It's
horrifying.
But I guess in those 10 years, now that it's being published in the UK, why is it being published over here now?
Well, I think the current appeal of Sherlock Holmes, of Benjamin, is it Benedict? Am I going to say it right?
No,
don't hit me. The Cumberbatch.
Go with what you know.
Yeah, go with what I know. Yeah. No, I think that helped a lot. That kind of revisionism. At the time, there was two camps when it came out. There were those, and they were usually the hardcore Sherlockians got what I was trying to do with the book, and were fine with it. Leslie Klinger wrote this really lovely review of it for the Los Angeles Times Book Review, and when that happened, I was like, oh, I'm okay.
Yeah, if you get Les's blessing, it's like...
Yeah, exactly. And actually, he showed up at a couple of events I did, so I was like, okay. I'm like...
Sherlockian royalty. Yeah.
So the hardcore people seemed to understand what I was doing, appreciated whatever amount of homework I had done to try and stay as true as I could to the canon. It was the kind of casual Sherlock Holmes fan that seemed to kind of, certain things would annoy them. Definitely the thing that really bugged people, that I got almost hate mail, was because I had him say that he never called Watson, he just called him John. That was just for my own amusement. That was just me, but it really bugged certain people. I don't know.
Wow.
Yeah, that was one of those things. But now on the Sherlock, he calls him John Watson or John sometimes, right?
Yeah.
So it's, but yeah, I think that's helped.
Yeah, because I remember reading that at first. I was like, what are you doing? Excuse me. And then when Holmes actually explained, he always says he's called him Watson. I'm like, no, he's called him John.
Right. Well, and
I thought it was a nice play with the characters, playing with the canon.
And it was one of those things I wanted to do to kind of, give Holmes his own, as if when Watson wrote the stories, he would call, he would have Holmes call him
Watson. It was very, very formal.
And they just kind of created a separation between the two, in a way, of the fictional Holmes and this
I
kind
have
of
lots
Holmes
of questions actually. To ask you about that, but we'll segue into
right,
that
right,
point,
so,
yeah.
But I think I've been fortunate, too, that Canongate has seen it as a literary novel and treated it as such, and I really appreciate that. So it's just, things have come together, and of course the film adaptation, that helps as well, so, yeah.
We're excited about that.
Me too.
Yeah, I guess just to backtrack, do you want to give a brief summary of the novel? Is giving anything away?
Sure, without any spoiler alerts. It's Sherlock Holmes in the twilight of his life in retirement in Sussex. He's 90. Is he 93?
93.
And I haven't read it in a long time. So
it's okay, you wrote it.
I did my work already.
10 years is enough where you can read it and enjoy it as a novel, I think.
Someday I need to just read them all. I don't usually read what I write. But his memory is kind of beginning to waver a bit, as it does with a lot of people of that age. And it's a book about memory and about kind of lost fathers, actually. So it's, that's in an essay, in a way. And he's got his bees, and he's working on his books and things. That sounds like a really interesting book to read.
Well, I think something to definitely say is that there's three storylines.
Yes.
The narrative structure, there's three different stories, and they sort of intertwine.
Yes.
Yeah, they're very, very neatly interwoven.
Initially, I was more ambitious with it in conception. It was going to be 5 stories.
Oh, wow.
This was the idea I had for it. And then it was too much for me to deal with. But it was going to be, the first half of it was going to be these 5 stories that had nothing to do with Sherlock Holmes. They were all going to seem unrelated. And then so it would be 5 short stories. And the second half of the book was going to be this novella, which was basically a slight trick of the mind. that tied all those characters and all those missing aspects into that one story.
Okay.
So it was going to be this kind of meta, you know, I'm clever and look at this thing. But it was a little, it became unwieldy. And so there was an entire story about Mr. Yumazaki's childhood that I was going to do with his growing up with his kind of crazy mother. And I forget what, there's another story that was going to be in there. But at some point I just had to narrow it down to the three, and then interweave them, which originally wasn't the idea. Then I was just going to have two short stories, and then, you know,
because the novel is split into three parts, but actually the stories are interwoven the whole way through.
Absolutely,
which I thought was quite interesting. I was expecting it to be sort of three distinctive stories, but
and then it kind of became this idea of like, I don't know if it really reads that way, but I was thinking at the time, well, it'd be like how our minds, our memories jump around. You know,
that's
you know,
the impression I got from it.
That was what I was trying for anyway. So that's good.
Go.
That's good.
There you go.
Yay!
Yeah, and just for listeners, like. It's the main, I guess maybe the main backbone of the story is the 93-year-old Holmes in Sussex. He's just gotten back from Kobe.
That's right.
Where he met Mr. Yumazaki. And then there's also this mystery case of the glass, and I can't pronounce that word.
Harmonica?
Yes. It's like harmonica, but with an A.
I know, I thought it was like, what? Like, I have no idea actually what it was. I went on YouTube, and I was just like, this is the most bizarre instrument I've ever seen in my life.
It's strange, and it was really popular in its day. It was like a synthesizer, and it's, you know, everyone was using
like
it.
That's exactly how
it's done.
Well, I mean, if you've done your finger around a wine glass, you kind of get the idea of
the harmonica,
the celestial music.
Yeah. So it's like, it's that mystery, and then
that's interesting because the glass harmonica part of the story is all written in first person, whereas the rest of it is all in the third person perspective.
Yeah. I guess because I was trying my hand to write a... That was probably the most pastiche part of the book, I suppose. And so I was trying... Pastiche.
That's a word.
It is now. Because I wanted just to try my hand at... I mean, as an American, it's a very silly thing to try to do, I think. But I think it would be hard for anybody to do it. I defy anyone to try and write in a way that kind of mirrors Doyle.
To be honest, like having read it, like, and not knowing anything about you, I wouldn't have said that you were an American, like, from reading
you.
It.
On many levels, thank you.
Because I think the thing is, like, when you write a book about, like, someone from another country, like, if the reader is so involved in it that you can guess nothing about the author, like, you've done your job, basically.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I tried. I mean, I wanted it to be believable to me now, you know, and then hoping that other people would at least go with it.
Yeah.
And then giving myself the omniscient voice part, being more my voice. So then I could, you know, that might have bothered some people, I don't know. But
I think that's what sets apart as, like, sort of a literary fictional piece, though.
Yeah, I think so, too.
Which I think is fine.
Yeah, no, I enjoyed Holmes. It's, like, the third person, like, his voice in it. Because there was a distinction between the fictional Holmes within the story, which is very meta.
Exactly.
When they talk about the study in Scarlet and everything, like, you do feel as if that is a character within the story, and that Holmes is someone a bit different, but like the same.
We're getting Watson's interpretation, you know, through Watson's filter, you know.
Yeah.
And then here's the real Sherlock Holmes off in Sussex, kind of.
And he disappoints people by being like, I don't wear the deer stalker.
Yeah, he doesn't wear the deer stalker, have the big pipe. And
and everyone's like, oh, really?
And I kind of think, I didn't put the violin in there, did I? Did I have him?
He doesn't. No, I didn't think he does play the violin.
I don't think
actually.
I had a... I'll revise it.
Just have like an insert. Yeah. Then Holmes played the violin.
And then the violin. He's silhouetted in a window as the camera pulls back.
Well, there is obviously the glass harmonica part does show that he has a very deep appreciation of music anyway.
Yeah.
There you go. See, you saved him.
Yeah, thank you. Well, that was my intention. I'll take credit for that.
Yeah.
Hmm. Why did you want to write an older Holmes?
Well, in truth, I was dealing with my father's, the early onset of his Alzheimer's or dementia. Mm-hmm. We're not sure, they don't really know for sure, but he had Alzheimer's or dementia, but it was the beginning of seeing him start to slip away a little bit and, you know, walking out of the house and not quite remembering what switch turned off the porch light, you know, things like that, and then it just kind of started increasing. And it was really horrifying, actually, because my father was a journalist and a writer and very sharp guy, and to see him suddenly, become an older man and kind of this kind of his mental capacity diminished was just something that I didn't know how to deal with, nor did any of my siblings. So what I do often or have done in the past is I try to work it out in some way through writing. So it becomes kind of me grappling with things that are kind of bigger than me that I'm not sure I understand. It also becomes me learning, you know. So I was reading a lot about also, and the thing is, all of this, I was writing Sidetrack of the Mind. I finished it before Dad got really bad, you know. But I it really prepared me for the trajectory of
for what would happen. Yeah.
And so then things that happened in the book ended up happening to my father. He would open, I was with him, or my sister was with him, and he opened a book, and there was something he had written, and he didn't even know what it was, you know? And I think there's something like that in the book. My sister called me.
Yeah, there is.
Yeah. She said he had a Sherlock moment, you know? But also, John Shaw died, and this was going on with my father, and I suddenly was feeling, for the first time, not so young, you know? It was a way of just kind of saying bye to my childhood, because I Sherlock Holmes definitely was, for me, very much I associate with me being a boy. And so Roger's a little bit of me. the father figures are my dad. So there's a lot of, you know, lost fathers in the book, and it's all just that kind of stuff. So it's doing writerly stuff with personal stuff.
Yeah, it did feel a bit like there was certain parts of the novel that, like, I feel like a lot of, I could identify with, like, a lot, like, on a personal level. Like, a lot of my grandparents suffered really badly from dementia and Alzheimer's, so I recognize all the things that were in there. And there was a lot of human stories that I think a lot of people recognize in it.
Yeah, and I wanted that. I wanted people who might not actually be Sherlock Holmes fans to be able to read it and have something that they could take away from it that would have nothing to do with the canon or... I did get it at the time when it came out in the States. I got several really angry letters which would say things, how can you do this, why would you do this to make him feeble, and very upset. And my response was, well, I had two things I would normally say, which is just that it is horrible when these things happen to people we care about, and you know, you obviously care about Sherlock Holmes a lot, and you don't want to see this happen to him. The good news is it's fiction, and you don't have to believe it. And you can write your own book. Or you can write a book about Sherlock Holmes reading this book and saying, what a bunch of crap.
Yeah. it's all open in the public domain now.
But those were mine. Those were. What was the question?
Well, I was an older Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah. It was, and you know, I like the idea of old Sherlock Holmes. Myself.
Kind of doddery, yeah.
Yeah, because, like, usually, like, people say, oh, he retired, and there's not a whole lot, like, after that that people write. No. So, I don't know, I thought it was very interesting, because it's not so much, like, a Sherlock Holmes story, it's a story about Sherlock Holmes.
Well, you know, I don't know if you know the book, but, and I hope I'm getting his name right, William S. Baring-Gould?
Yes!
And he wrote, and I met him, actually, back a long time ago. He came out to the Santa Fe Film Festival when I was a kid. And I had read his Sherlock Holmes on Baker Street. I think is that the name of the book?
Yeah, his biography.
Yeah, and I was a go to book sometimes as I was writing this, because he had a timeline of things, and he had little nice touches that were really, you know, I could look at and kind of get ideas of where Holmes would be at certain, you know, age. Mm-hmm. I think he had a description even of the bench or something by the cliffs, and so I used that book as kind of a. Pretending it was a biography of Holmes. But yeah, and another book is H.F. Hurd's A Taste for Honey, which is, if you haven't read it, read it. It's really great. It's a character named Mycroft, not Sherlock. And I think this was a copyright issue back in the day, so H.F. Hurd did three books with this old, retired guy who's living, I think, maybe even in Sussex. He's a bee farmer. Was named Mycroft, and but the one called The Taste for Honey is fantastic. It's a really good murder mystery, and that was also one of the ones that I loved as a kid, and that I wanted to kind of reference when I was working on this one, because it was clearly Holmes. The writer was conjuring Holmes. But,
Well, what is it? Because I mean, obviously, him being 93 like puts him in a very specific time period, and the use of, like, there's a lot of references to the First World War, but mainly the Second World War. Right. Was that more like deliberate than just having him at that age? Yeah,
because I mean, when you think of Holmes, I think just in general, you think of, maybe not so much now, come to think of it, with the Cumberbatch show, but definitely at the time when you say Sherlock Holmes, immediately the Victorian era and foggy London and all those things just swirl up, and it seems as if it's part of a different world order, you know, that he belonged at a different time, even though he's very rock star like in his day, you know. with the violin and the cocaine and there was this moment where the world really shifted into the modern age, and for me, I say it's, you know, Hiroshima when the bomb dropped. Other people have their own idea of that, but and I just thought, well, wouldn't it be interesting to put the old Sherlock, what would he make of this world, you know?
Right.
How would he perceive it? What would his way of viewing it in terms of where he's been and what he's experienced? He would probably, I don't know if he would feel like he fit in all that well in the modern world.
It was interesting because he would go between the sort of a sense that he recognizes things within people but still feels like a stranger at the same time.
Yeah,
especially like the sections where he's in Japan. Yeah. He like very much knows that he's a stranger there because it's a different world, like... Like, there's a comment in the book actually about that, like they live in parallel universes,
yeah,
like in England and in Japan. I thought it was quite interesting.
Well, I mean, as I started writing the book, I realized, oh, well, England and Japan actually have some strange things in common. I mean, you wouldn't think it on face value, but island nations and, you know, there's a very, I think when you think of both countries, you think of some hardcore tradition and culture and, I don't know, there was just certain parallels that I saw. I just thought that Holmes in the modern age interested me a little bit. Plus, there were things I was interested in. And when I first went to Japan for the first time by myself, I felt completely bewildered and not of that world, you know? So I could at least relate to that, you know?
Yeah, especially like a post like atomic bomb Japan.
Yeah,
I thought it was just very touching when Roger was asking Hope, like, what was it like? He's like, I can't explain it.
Yeah.
Because just, like, the horror of, like, what's actually happened there. I think just because his life at this point just spans so many, like, decades, like, over a century that he's seen so much. And I think, especially as he's older, just trying to rationalize it is so hard.
At the time, my grandmother was still alive, and she was approaching 101, I think. And she lived in a retirement community in Arizona, and her roommate was 2 years older than her. And her roommate used to push her in a wheelchair. So her 103-year-old roommate would push her to the cafeteria. And my grandmother would complain that she's being pushed too fast, which used to crack me up. But her roommate was named Portia. And my grandmother had once said, you know, Portia has almost dipped her toes into 3 centuries. And it was such a weird thing to think about it, because she had been born in, you know,
like,
18-something and lived through the 20th century. And it was now... You know, and so I guess I realized, wow, what a sweep of history this woman has seen.
Yes.
You know, and made me that also was one of those things that, you know, I thought, wow, you would have seen in that short period of time, really relatively short period of time, the world changed incredibly.
Well, the world changed incredibly rapidly in the early part of the 20th century.
Yeah.
I mean, you wouldn't have recognized, like,
you
know,
and what it meant to be English changed a lot too.
Yeah.
So post World War II.
It's quite interesting, like, I just had this random thought, like, in the middle of it, like, there'd be a fascinating story about him, because he obviously lived in Sussex during the Second World War, if he was made to take in refugee children from London.
Oh, yeah.
That could be, like, another story there.
All right, he did.
Yeah.
He did.
You imagine
that's the lost chapter of A Slight Trick of the Mind.
Yeah, he took in some refugees, and they learned to love through each other.
They
know?
Did. He ended up drowning them, though.
Is that
Tom? But it's in my mind, it's not Sherlock.
You should see, now there's your book.
Yeah, that's my book.
There's your book.
I do have a question from Taylor, who wasn't able to be here. See if I can read my own handwriting. Oh, she was talking about what you thought the overall message of the novel was. Because she was saying, like, it's sort of like... she was saying, like, there's sort of like this message of hope, but by the end of it, it feels like Holmes doesn't have much hope, that he's so isolated, but maybe that's like a antithesis sort of thing.
Well, maybe it's not a very explicit message, but maybe it's you know, stay connected, don't isolate, you know, and it's important to open yourself up to being human and all the messiness that goes with that, you know, that intellect is a tool. It shouldn't be the primary driving force of one's existence. That would be at least what I would. However, I'm not a very good writer at interpreting my own work. I tend to want other people to take from it whatever they get, even if it's negative. I think I've always thought it must have been a fairly lonely life for old Sherlock Holmes out there, you know.
Yeah, there is a sense, like, all the way through the novel of his kind of isolated loneliness.
Yeah. but if you read The Beekeeper's Apprentice, you'll feel a lot better about him being out there because he's got a wife. And
yeah, it was funny because, like, when, like, I finally got the books sent to me and I, like, post a picture, I'm like, oh, yay, and it has so many of the readers in the States who are like, don't read it, you're going to cry.
Someone threw it across the room. They were so mad at it. I remember they said, I got your crummy book. I read it halfway. You did all right. And then I had to a certain part that I would be a spoiler, so I won't say. And I threw it across the room. I won't. You know, it was just this angry. That's a fair response, you know.
Well, I mean, that's one of the things about, like, a really good novel is that they do make people react like that. And whether that's because of the writing or because of how deeply they feel about Sherlock Holmes.
That's it. I think because we have this kind of strange thing where we know he's a fictional character and we absolutely believe he's real.
Yes.
And I guess I broke the contract. I decided to believe he was totally real and as a result was going to suffer all the things that human beings that exist in this world, or some of the things anyway, or some human beings experience. So sadness, loneliness, you know, elder issues, you know, these things. Other people, well, why didn't you at least have Watson in there? You know, or why'd you have to kill everyone off? Or, and I, you know, but had they all been there, it would have been closer to the pastiche zone. Yeah. You know, it would have been, the sense of loss wouldn't have felt necessarily as acute for me writing it and for the character, my version of the character, and for the reader. You know, I just didn't want to write a pastiche. I could have done it, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, there were certain points of the novel where I actually did completely forget that it was Sherlock Holmes who was, like, talking to, he was, you know, even in the third-person narration, and then they would get out the copy of A Study in Scarlet, and I'd be like, oh, yeah, this is about that, okay.
Well, have you ever seen, is there a band you really love, maybe from the 60s or something, and just like, and the guy is like, oh, he's so hot, and he's so great, and listen to his voice, and then you hear, oh, they're going to get back together, and you're like, woo, yeah, and then the guy comes out and you're like, who the hell is that?
Yeah.
And why does he sound like that? And oh no, Or have you ever dated somebody that was really hot back in the day? And then you're like, oh, what happened? What happened?
Or someone's like, thank God I had.
Exactly. You know, but we want people to stay the same, you know, and I think, you know.
Remain unchanging.
But I think in The Beekeeper's Apprentice, for example, she's Laurie King, who I did some events with her. She wrote this pastiche, but in talking to her and getting to know her, it was actually a very personal story for her. She was much younger than her husband. He was a professor of hers. And you realize that these people who are also writing their version of Sherlock Holmes also are mixing in elements of their own stew. To tell this.
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the things I like about those kind of novels is where that you can tell that there has been, like, so much input from the writer about, like, your own personal experiences, and it adds, like, a really nice texture to the novel, like, a depth to it.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. I like to use it's a sad thing that, like, most of my viewers don't know how many, like, hand gestures I make whilst I, like, do these recordings.
Massive gesticulations going on.
You had Watson questions.
Oh.
Watson questions, did I?
Yeah, you did.
I did. I did write down things like that. Okay, well, the first question actually I wanted to ask beforehand is, because a lot of the novels, the original novels, are mostly written by Watson. There's only, like, a few of them that are actually written from the perspective of Holmes. And I was wondering if that made it easier to then interpret Holmes yourself.
Much, yeah. Actually. Yeah. And in fact, I don't. What's the one that he wrote? The Lion's Mane, or
Lion's Mane? When he attacks a giant jellyfish, and no one believes
it. I made a deliberate choice not to even look at that one when I was doing the whole. Just because I felt like I had a little more freedom to. I think it would be really hard to write a Sherlock Holmes story in the Conan Doyle Watson voice. For me, it would be.
Some people, it's a real pastiche kind of thing.
It's tricky to get it. But if you get it right, then it's absolutely beautiful.
Right.
But there's a lot of people who don't.
Yeah.
But
not mentioning any names.
That's tough. Yeah. Have you guys read the Solar Pond stories? Do you know any of those?
No,
the August Derleth? They're really great. They're my favorite pastiches. This guy, and I think he's an American, and he's in the maybe the 30s and 40s, maybe later. But his name was August Derleth. and massive Sherlock Holmes fan, but he couldn't, and he wanted to write Sherlock Holmes stories, and he obviously couldn't. So he wrote his own world. So instead of Baker Street, I think it's Solar Ponds instead of Sherlock Holmes, which is a ridiculous name.
Solar Ponds.
And Dr. Parker. And I forget what the street is, but they're great. If you can find any of these, I don't know if they're even in print, but there's like the Casebook of Solar Ponds and the Adventures of Solar Ponds. And
it doesn't even sound like that.
Parallel universe. And they're really wonderful pasties. And I think even after he died, somebody else tried to carry it on.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there's like several. But if you can, Canongate, you guys should track down the solar ponds and put them out.
They sound amazing. Yeah, no, that's one of the things I enjoyed, actually, was the way that, like, Sherlock keeps debunking, like, everything about, like, that's written in the novels. Like, there's this really wonderful, like, meta comment about how, like, Watson is always perceived as to be, like, an idiot, and even, like, Holmes says something like, you know, if it was going to be made into a stage play, then, you know, that would work for comedic reasons. It's really interesting, like, the way he comments on, like, actual things that have been created. I just thought that was so funny.
Well, I was thinking if he's real, and we all of us who love the stories know that Watson actually wasn't dumb at all. He was just wasn't. I mean, Sherlock Holmes was
so smart
that you know anybody around him looked like a dwarf. So, I just thought it would be that funny for that. What kind of things would rankle the real Sherlock Holmes, especially with Watson gone? I think that would probably bother me. Probably, John was a smart guy. He didn't get his due. But then I don't know. I should have had him blame Watson a bit for playing himself down so much.
He does sort of a little bit. He sort of says, he was quite humble in his writing of himself.
I did that. Okay, good.
Yeah. You did do that. Yeah. I mean, I don't want to spoil obviously too much for people who haven't read it, but there is he doesn't appear in the novels, Watson, but there is a few mentions to him all the way through, and even in the story actually that Holmes tells, as we're going through the novel, the Glass Harmonica. Yeah. Even Watson doesn't appear in that either.
Because he's on holiday with his third wife.
Yeah, that's right. The third wife is mentioned a few times.
The mysterious. Did we ever establish that Watson had a third wife?
It's that one of those things that's debated.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. That's one of them.
I did actually have a question about Mr. Umezeki's father, who was mentioned in the novel. Now, I won't say what is revealed about him, but did you, in your mind, have an idea of what really happened to him, or have you just kind of left that, not really thought about it?
I'm trying to think back. Mm. I think I didn't have a definitive answer in my own mind. But I'm saying that, I'm choosing to say that, because I think in order to write it the way I did, I knew it wasn't necessarily relevant that I actually knew.
That you actually knew what happened to him.
But it's not, it's conceivable that I absolutely knew.
When you were doing it. It was good. There was a lot of there's a lot of him using his powers of deduction to help people, shall we say, in certain ways, and I think it's interesting because it does add again more of a human element to him that he would do that for.
I love one of the tricks of the Conan Doyle stories and the things of Holmes. We're amazed at his deductions or the things he draws from people, but the trick in the books are really interesting because Holmes will say something that is seeing things the reader's not privy to. And he'll say, I can see from this and this and this and this, and then, wow, you're reading this, but you're not actually getting a visual on it. And then he'll then go in and dissect it. And it's a little trick, and then you're like, oh, wow.
Right? How did you know that?
So it was fun to actually kind of play with that, too. Mm. Now, on the Cumberbatch show, sometimes he seemed psychic. I noticed that. How did he know that?
It
was
just
like, your wife is cheating on you. You walk by somebody and just say, your wife is cheating on you. But you, because it's Sherlock Holmes, you believe that.
Yeah, of course.
You believe that. I think what is quite interesting is that he does say that a lot of stuff that he does is just an educated guess.
Yeah.
He might not be right, but often he's
usually right.
He's quite intuitive.
So, can we talk about the movie?
What movie?
So, yeah, Twitter just went mad when this was announced because obviously Ian McKellen.
I know.
How excited are you?
I was floating. I mean, you can attest. It was a long time coming. Well, here's the other thing. I had to be quiet. It had been bubbling about him being in it for about 2 years. But I was sworn to secrecy. I could not say anything. So I had to actually be, so you know, I mean, I would drink my beer at night and just be, oh, please happen, please happen. So I had to actually be mum about it for a long time. And, you know, the film, the producer, Ann Carey, and she's amazing. If you want to look up somebody who has done incredible films, type in Ann Carey. She's an unsung hero of cinema, American cinema. She read the book before it even came out in the States, and I think did an option on it even before it was published, with the belief that it would make a great film. She completely related to it, and she single-handedly held on to it for all these years. And Ian McKellen had always been one of those people that who would be your ideal Holmes for this. You know, he was in the top five, if not at the very top for me. Christopher Lee, too, was in there. I thought he would be great.
I was like, for ages, I thought it was Christopher Lee who was in the role. That's just who comes into my mind.
Exactly.
When I think
you can
of
visualize
him.
Yeah. But I was just, it couldn't have. And then with Bill Condon coming in to direct, it was just kind of, how great is that? You reunite these two men who've worked well together. And a few months ago, I had dinner with Bill Condon and just talked about, you know, the film, and I mean, I just walked away feeling like, ah, it's just in good hands. You know, it's going to be fine. It's going to be great. And I think he'll bring the poignancy to it that will work for this particular character. I think it'd be a hard role for some actors to play, but when you hear Ian McKellen, you just have no doubt he'll be.
Yeah, it's like, yes.
It'll be fine. Yeah. It'll be fine.
It's just going to be so heartbreaking.
I know. Bring your tissues.
Yeah, and Laura Linney's in it as well.
Yes. Oh.
I love her.
She's apparently a big Sherlock Holmes fan.
Yeah, she is.
You guys should try and get her on the podcast when they're
filming. They're starting production on it this summer.
Yeah. Oh, are they? So we could.
So we can just show up to set one day, like, hi.
You really should get Ian McKellen and Laura Linney on the. I mean, come on, they have to do it. So yeah.
So is this the first one of your novels that's being made into a film?
Second, right? Actually. Second. Yeah, Thailand with Terry Gilliam. That's one. Great for me, maybe not so great for a lot of other people, but it was a very good experience for me.
Yes.
And for Terry, too. He had a good time making it. But in that regard, it's a very different films, very different stories. Mm. One's about a little girl. This one's about an elderly gentleman. And so this will be a whole different experience. One very surreal, the other... I don't think it will be all that surreal, you know, but...
Depends, I suppose it depends how much they play with the kind of the memory thing.
Yeah, I wonder, you know, and I haven't read the script. I have it. I just haven't read I don't have much of a desire to, and it's not because I have any issues. It's just that...
You can watch the film and enjoy
it. Yeah. And I'm not a writer that feels particularly freaked out if they change things. I mean, that's films are films, books are books. I've done my job, and they're going to do a great job with theirs. You know, I hope they'll get meta in certain ways. You know, I think it would be nice to see Sherlock Holmes... elderly Sherlock Holmes watching, a Basil Rathbone movie or something.
Yeah, that's funny. I don't know, the bit where they go to Japan, I think I may just cry my eyes out the whole way.
I know. And I don't know how much, I don't know how they're going to do it. I don't know how they're, I mean, I guess I could read the script and find out. I don't know how they're going to condense all that into a 2-hour movie.
A lot of novels surrounding the Second World War, especially in England, like focus on like the victory and the victory spirit of the British people.
Yeah.
But this was like there's a deep contrast in this to do with like the defeatism that existed in Japan at that time. And I found that really fascinating to read about.
I read a really great book at the time while I was working on, it was around the time called Embracing Defeat by a guy named John Dewey. It's about post-war Japan. It's nonfiction. Absolutely gave me great insight to the psyche of the Japanese people at that time. And this kind of defeat, you know, they'd never been defeated before, ever.
Mm.
And this also sense of rebirth, too. I mean, it was this kind of like leveling. Everything was just flattened.
Mm.
And they also had their very notion of God just destroyed. Because it was the emperor was God, you know. And they had that. And I thought, how would that feel? What would that feel like, you know, if suddenly, I don't know, Al-Qaeda stepped in and said... you know, sorry, doesn't exist, we're the real deal, and you're going to have to deal with it. I think it would be, you would have to, your brain would have to
readjust
in a different way. So I found that fascinating. But that's a book plug, because I think it's an incredible book, is Embracing Defeat by John Dewey.
Are there any scenes from the novel that you just really hope are in the movie?
Oh, boy. Well, I don't think it'll be in there, but I always like the dead baby part. I know that sounds You know, and yeah. It came from a real experience, actually. When we were in Tucson, yeah. It wasn't a baby, it was a dog. But we were walking on our way to a liquor store, and we passed this woman just sitting on the curb bawling, holding her dog that had just been hit, you know. And it was just this help, I mean, just hysterical and in shock. And we sat down with her, and we were trying to console her. And it was just, at the time, it was the saddest thing I had ever seen. It just stuck with me. So, you know, it's one of those things you want to work into the book, but I'm not so sure the dead dog would have worked quite as well unless you actually.
There was a lot of poignant moments, I thought, for like women in the book, and there was a lot of about. I always find the subject fascinating of like how much the Victorians didn't understand about the suffering that women went through and certain kinds of psychological conditions that they just didn't understand.
Because you guys were all hysterical. Yeah, that was always
laudanum, you know. Yeah. There's a good book about that actually called Sleep Pale's Sister.
Oh, really?
Which is about laudanum addiction. Yeah,
I would like to read that.
Yeah, you think it's a good book actually? It's a little bit surreal. It's written by the same woman who wrote Chocolat.
I don't know this book.
That's a good book as well.
Is it called
Chocolat? It's spelled like chocolate, but it's pronounced the French way because it's set in France.
Okay.
Ooh. But like the Sleep Pale's Sister is about a woman who is. Her husband is like she's hysterical and she becomes addicted to laudanum, but there's like a lot of really surreal stuff about how they get revenge on the husband and it's a good novel.
And then you have Freud, who is trying to, but really everything that Freud said about women was really about men. I think Freud does a decent job dissecting the male psyche. I think he did okay, not perfect, but a horrible job with women. But he applied all this stuff to
them like men.
He treated them like men, and you know, so the misogyny that women, I mean, I know I have older sisters. I come from a female-centric family, let's say, very matriarchal family. But, you know, the way women are treated in this time, which is, you know, you'd say is pretty good, but it's still shocking at times. Mm. So you can only imagine what it must have been like to be a woman in Victorian England. I mean, it's almost inhuman way of being a woman. You know, how could you live up to that?
Unless you were in perfect health, you know.
You would go crazy, I think, right?
Just locked inside all day, you would.
Because there was the guy in the case who was like, oh, my wife, she's not doing her chores.
Yeah.
It's like really a big issue.
His main concern is
just like, I hate you.
That like stuck with me a lot. It did remind me a lot of like Sleep Pale Sister, that whole The Glass Harmonica section of it.
Yeah, it's just like her grief just culminates in just playing this constantly. And
yeah, just
it's taken away from her.
It'll be interesting to see how it plays out in the film. We know someone who knows somebody who does harmonica music. We don't know the person themselves, but so
a friend of a friend.
Yeah. And there was a guy in Albuquerque, New Mexico, who was still making them, and I don't.
Oh wow!
And then he disappeared. His plea like took off in a plane and disappeared, and no one knows what happened to him. So it's like the mystery.
Glass harmonica man.
It keeps going, you know, the aura the legend, of evilness around the thing. You know?
Ooh, it's weird. Yeah. I really want to see one now. I think
they're super weird looking.
Yeah.
Benjamin, I think it might say the
Benjamin Franklin. Franklin.
Yeah, he invented it.
He was a bit of a loon.
He was kind of Will Ferrell-esque. Who would be our Benjamin? We don't have a Benjamin Franklin, do we? Not anymore. No, inventor, politician. He wanted the turkey to be our which is great.
I think the turkey should have been the American national bird.
it's delicious and it.
And it looks funny.
Then we'd be eating eagle on Thanksgiving. Well, anything else? I'm at your disposal. If you
my list, like where obviously people can buy the book from Canongate. Yes. It's being published in the UK on Thursday.
It's got a pretty new cover.
Yeah. I like that cover. It's a very nice cover.
And where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me on Facebook. I think I'm Mitch the Cullen, but you can just type in Mitch Cullen on Facebook and I'll pop up, I think. And I'm on the Twitter.
The Twitter.
And Amazon.com.
You want to write an just angry
Google,
review?
Just Google Mitch Cullen, and you'll, you know, yeah. If you want to write an angry review, go to.
Video reviews on Canongate TV.
Oh yes, that's right. Don't miss me on Canongate TV, with wonderful interviews and footage of my beautiful face.
Yes, yeah, so go read. It's like checking the mind. Bring tissues.
Yeah.
Bring all your tissues.
All your tissues, and then send all your hate mail to Mitch.
Just remember, it's fiction.
It is a fictional
it's
novel.
It's fiction.
Yeah.
Yay!
All right.
Well, thank you very much.
No, thank you. Are you kidding? I got a snazzy button.
If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you too?